morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bonganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, February the 11th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Uganda has rejected a ruling from the UN's International Court of Justice, ordering it to pay war reparations to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The fact that we might not be able to resolve this matter diplomatically, which might not require paying any money, and if there is another possible legal options, involve paying money.
And rights groups have criticized the European Union for lifting sanctions against Burundi.
It's unfortunately premature. Nothing on the ground in Burundi gives any foundation or basis for lifting of sanctions.
And after 2 years of struggling to contain the deadly spread of COVID-19, the World Health Organization reports that the African continent is poised to control the trajectory of the pandemic. We'll have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Uganda has rejected a ruling from the UN's International Court of Justice, ordering it to pay war reparations to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Analysts say that Uganda could have avoided the $325 million fine if it had agreed to mediation. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
In a statement, Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs described the ruling from the International Court of Justice as unfair and wrong. On Wednesday, the UN court ordered that Uganda pay $325 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo as reparations for damages to people, property, and resources inflicted during Uganda's invasion of DRC's Ituri region in the late 1990s during the Second Congo War. Foreign Affairs Minister Okello Henry Oryem said the judgment singled out Uganda for punishment, ignoring the presence of other countries' armed forces in Ituri during the period. He also denied the Ugandan army committed abuses in Ituri, saying the army is a very disciplined force.
The judgment of 2005 gave the DRC the burden of proof of the number of people they claim were killed, the number of properties they claim were destroyed. By the time this judgment was made yesterday, the DRC had not proved those issues that were raised.
VOA reached out to the DRC's information minister for comment on the ruling, but the ministry said he did not have time to talk. The ICJ ruling calls for Uganda to make annual payments of $65 million beginning this September, continuing until 2026. But Uganda's Oryem says paying the money is not really the issue.
The fact that we might not be able to resolve this matter diplomatically, which might not require paying any money, and if there is another possible legal options, involve paying money.
The DRC has pursued reparations for the invasion for decades. In 2002, officials from Congo and Uganda met in Gambia and tried to negotiate some of the issues. The DRC filed its first case with the International Court of Justice in 2005, and the court ordered Uganda to pay $11 billion. Uganda refused, and the countries resumed negotiations. However, security analyst Dismas Nkunda, who attended the meeting, says Uganda failed to sign.
They are lucky that the amount has been reduced. They are lucky that they have been given installments. This is a matter of Minister of Justice and Attorney General's office to have dealt with in the beginning. It wouldn't have come to this.
Uganda says it will continue to constructively engage with the DRC on the matter. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
And still in East Africa, the East African Community Council of Ministers has approved the admission of DRC into the bloc. This comes after negotiations earlier this week between DRC and the regional bloc. Moses Havyarimana has more on this story.
During the 46th Extraordinary Summit meeting of the East African Community Council of Ministers, the Council recommended the admission of Democratic Republic of Congo into the East African Community. Peter Matuki is the Secretary General of the East African Community.
And this Council of Ministers was considering a report on negotiations that have been taking place between the East African Community and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this is in line with the directive that was given by the heads of states, where they directed the council and the Secretariat to fast-track negotiations. So we have since started the negotiations. Negotiations are complete. Now that report is ready to go to the summit, where the summit will officially admit DRC.
Article 3 of the treaty establishing the East African Community indicates that any foreign country applying to be a member of the bloc shall adhere to universally acceptable principles of good governance, democracy, the rule of law, observance of human rights and social justice. Adan Mohamed, the chairman of the East African Council of Ministers, he explains the benefits of joining the community.
Being part of the community has substantial benefits for each of the member states. And I think the power of the size, be it in terms of population, in terms of the market size, in terms of the natural resources, and human capital that we can bring together jointly as the community, we will be able to benefit the citizens of our country, of our region.
In December last year, during the Heads of State Summit, the East African Community member states authorized the ministers to conduct another round of talks with the Democratic Republic of Congo on how it can be admitted to the bloc. Fred Mukasambide is a lawmaker from the East African Legislative Assembly.
The admission by Congo, obviously, that is most likely going to be cemented by April this year, will go a long way to ameliorate the bloc as a trade and investment destination. It is going to be one of the best economic sub-regions within the African continent. Definitely, Congo and all the EAC partner states will benefit from further economies of integration, especially at full implementation of the four pillars of integration.
When admitted, DRC will be the seventh partner state forming the East African Community. The admission of the Democratic Republic of Congo in the community is expected to boost the region's GDP to $240 billion from $193 billion. Moses Havyarimana for Voice of America.
After 2 years of struggling to contain the deadly spread of COVID-19, the World Health Organization reports that the African continent is poised to control the trajectory of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The first case of COVID-19 was detected in Africa on February 14, 2020. Since then, more than 11 million people have been infected on the continent and more than 242,000 have died. The World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the pandemic has taken a toll in terms of lives lost and the incalculable damage done to African economies. Despite all this, she says the African people have battled and survived four waves and several variants of the infection. During this trying period, she says Africa has become smarter, faster, and better at responding to each new surge in COVID-19 cases.
As we stand here today, we're finally able to say that if the current trends hold, there is light at the end of the tunnel. As long as we remain vigilant and we act intensively, particularly on vaccination, the continent is on track for controlling the pandemic. It's been an extremely difficult 2 years, but against all odds, Africa is weathering this terrible storm.
Africa has made great progress over the past 2 years in managing COVID-19 cases. WHO reports the number of intensive care unit beds and oxygen production plants has increased. The UN Health Agency also has increased the number of laboratories able to detect COVID-19 from 2 to more than 900 today. Despite these and other improvements, Moeti says vaccination remains the best defense against this deadly disease. She also notes African countries continue to lag behind other countries in inoculating their populations.
While many countries are considering booster shots, 85% of Africans have yet to receive a single shot. To reach the levels of immunity achieved in other parts of the world, vaccine uptake needs to be significantly accelerated across the region and urgently.
Moeti says a steady supply of doses is now reaching Africa, but is not enough to change the situation for the better. Getting those life-saving shots into people's arms, she says, requires faster and more effective vaccine rollouts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Rights groups have criticized the European Union for lifting sanctions this week against Burundi for what the EU said was progress on human rights, good governance, and the rule of law. The EU action follows the US lifting sanctions in November. Rights groups say Burundi authorities continue to commit abuses, including against political dissidents. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
The European Union is bringing the Burundi government into its political and economic system after being in the cold for at least 6 years. The European body said it was convinced political progress had been made in the Central African country. In a statement, it said it acknowledges the progress made by the Burundian government on human rights issues, rule of law and good governance, and wants to do more to improve its rights and governance record. The decision to leave the sanction has angered human rights groups. Mousi Segun is the Executive Director for Human Rights Watch Africa Division.
It's unfortunately premature. Nothing on the ground in Burundi gives any foundation or basis for lifting of sanctions. The EU and others like that institution are too much in a haste to give credit to the government of Burundi where none is due. The victims of abuses and vicious crimes in Burundi deserve a lot more from the international community.
The EU follows the US, which lifted sanctions imposed on Burundi in 2015 when the country witnessed protests against then Pierre Nkurunziza. In stopping the protests, Burundi security forces were accused of committing widespread rights violations against opponents and opposition groups. The lifting of the sanctions is guided by the 2020 political transition from late President Pierre Nkurunziza to the current leader, Evariste Ndayishimiye. When taking office in June 2020, President Ndayishimiye pledged to unite the country and deliver peace and justice to all. Segun says the human rights situation has remained the same under the new government.
The killings, the disappearances of suspects, people suspected by the government of working with political opposition or with so-called rebel groups, all of this continued to happen. In the last 1.5 years that Ndayishimiye has been in office, we have seen hundreds of these types of cases, hundreds of cases of Burundians who have been killed unlawfully in that country, and the disappearances of many more.
In September 2021, a UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi, tasked to document human rights violations, said under Ndayishimiye's government, no reforms have been undertaken to improve the human rights situation. Karina Tatsekian works with the Burundi Human Rights Initiative. She said the European Union can use a newfound engagement with Burundi to address the abuses and killings.
Now, with this more positive climate between the EU and Burundi, that can be an incentive for the Burundian government to actually take some concrete actions to reform and to improve the human rights situation. But in my view, that will only happen if the European Union on its side continues raising these concerns. There is an ongoing political dialogue between the EU and Burundi, and that is a very good opportunity to continue asking the Burundian government to address these issues.
Human Rights Watch is calling on those responsible for human rights violations and abuses, whether in government or ruling party youth wing, accountable for the abuses, and the international community to pay more attention to what is happening in Burundi. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
French leaders and their counterparts in the European Union are considering how to move forward with their anti-extremist military operations in the Sahel, especially in Mali. Tensions between Mali and the EU, especially France, have frayed in recent months as Mali's military government has delayed to return to civilian rule. It has been further complicated by Mali's decision to hire the Russian mercenary group, the Wagner Group, to help fight militant extremists in the region. Next week, leaders from the EU and the African Union will hold a summit in Brussels. The agenda is expected to include the EU's Takuba Task Force, a military support operation in the Sahel, and the French military's Operation Barkhane. Catherine Field is an analyst and journalist in Paris who follows the issues in the Sahel. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson Thursday about the tense relationship and what is expected at next week's summit.
We are essentially waiting for an EU-African Union summit, which happens in Brussels next week, to find out what steps the French are going to take for the next phase of their drawdown out of Mali. Now, we're not sure yet how this will work out. What we do know is that the French foreign minister has said there will be a decision taken because the situation cannot stay as it is. That red line for France was, of course, the presence in Mali of the Wagner Group, the so-called Russian mercenaries that the junta in Mali is accused of bringing in to help them out, if you like, to secure the area, particularly in Bamako. So we're not really entirely sure how the decision is going to be made with the French, whether they're going to regroup more and more around Gao, have their Barkhane forces there, or if they're going to say, no, this line has really been crossed by the Mali junta. Wagner are there. We're not hearing the right sounds when it comes to the presidential and parliamentary elections in Mali. We will then move off to Niamey and Rebase. A certain point is that the French want to give all this over to the European Union, have that Takuba force there as the face of the European Union rather than France.
Some of the EU members that have been participating in this effort in the Sahel, they have been expressing doubt about the situation. What's likely to come out of the EU? Is there any sense so far?
Not really. All we know is that they are trying to make this an international issue. What they're moving it away from, that it's not a Franco-Malian issue, it's an international community issue, that the international community has to deal with Sahel. So you're quite right that the Norwegians are dragging their feet, the Estonians are concerned, and the German parliament will have to make some sort of decision on extending the deployment of their Bundeswehr operation. We do get the feeling that we're coming to a moment when all of the EU is going to have to act with one voice, and they do seem to be coordinating very much with the ECOWAS and with the African Union, so it's not going to look as though it's just the Europeans.
Is there any consideration of other options? Instead of using military trainers, military operations to deal with the extremism issue, the violence in the Sahel, looking at other ways to bring in aid, provide employment, hospitals, schools, anything like that. Is there any consideration of taking a different tack?
This has been the subject for the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years. The European Union has been talking about the need to really go, if you like, go back to basics, to try and give some sort of support to local communities, to get that support in there, not just, as you say, with healthcare and with schools, but to prop up local villages who are now, particularly in Mali, in a very difficult position, because you do have the jihadists who are targeting resource areas, they're charging people tax revenues, and they're occupying huge swathes of the country. So you're seeing local officials really finding that they have to do deals with these jihadists because there's no one else around. So they are also looking at that. But they are very cognizant that, particularly when it comes to Mali, this is a multi-layered issue. This is something that touches not just on security. You're looking at the political implications. You're also looking at the socio-economic implications of what's been going on there.
That was Catherine Field. She's an analyst and journalist based in Paris. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and with that we go to Abuja with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sport with the latest FIFA rankings released on Thursday for the month of February. Newly crowned AFCON champions Senegal is the best African team in Africa. Senegal not only retained their position as the highest ranked African country, but also moved from 20th to 18th in the global ranking. This is the highest rank ever for the Teranga Lions, who are still celebrating their maiden AFCON success, where they beat Egypt via penalty shootouts in the final at the Olympic Stadium in Yaoundé on Sunday. Morocco occupies the second spot in Africa, but 24th globally. The Atlas Lions were stopped in the quarterfinals of the AFCON 2021 by Northern African rivals Egypt. In the third position is Nigeria. Despite the early exit from the just-concluded African Cup of Nations in Cameroon, they occupy the 32nd position globally. Egypt sits at the 34th position, but 4th on the continent, and Tunisia is 5th on the continent, but is ranked 36th in the world to wrap up the top 5. Staying with football news, it's match day 1 in the CAF Champions League, Africa's premier club competition, as it resumes this weekend with 7 group stage fixtures across the continent. The action opens on Friday evening with 3 matches. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will tackle Al Hilal of Sudan in a Group A clash. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will tackle Al Hilal in a Group A clash, while Etoile du Sahel will host Sia Belzedad in the Group C North African Derby. Will look to get off to a victory in the fast start in Group D when they host Sargada Esperanca. In Friday's late kickoff, it will be at the Stade Mohammed V when Wydad Athletic Club play Sargada Esperanca. On Saturday, it will be Petro de Luanda who will be away to Zamalek, while an earlier kickoff will see Botswana upstarts Jaweng Galaxy hoping to get the better of Esperance de Tunis in a Group C clash. The action wraps up with a late kickoff on Saturday as another team marks their debut at this stage of the competition, with South Africa's AmaZulu heading to Morocco to face Raja Casablanca. South Africa Olympic swimmer, who surprised many with her world record and gold medal performance in the pool at the Tokyo Olympics last year, says her next goal is excelling at the Commonwealth Games. Her 200 meters breaststroke triumph proved to be South Africa's sole gold medal in Japan and was her country's first female medal in an Olympic pool since the great Penny Haines took bronze in 2000. Her target now is to have a podium finish in Birmingham later in the year.
My first major international medal was also at Commonwealth Games in 2018. So, yeah, Commonwealth Games, I'm very excited. And that's basically it for the year.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great weekend. Also, remember to tune in this weekend to Nightline Africa. Host Peter Cloti has an exclusive interview with Ugandan writer Kakwenza Rukira Basaija, who fled the country this week after over a month in detention, where he says he was tortured.
I will not be the first person to do that. My mentor, Dr. Kizza Besigye, in 2001 after elections, he ran out of the country, and in 2005 he returned. Yeah, I'll do that. Right now I've already got an international passport that can enable me to move anywhere I want, and yeah, it will enable me to move to Entebbe. So I do not see any reason why I should not come back home and through Entebbe. Why should use porous borders to come back to Uganda? No.
That is Ugandan writer Kakwenza Rukira Basaija speaking to Peter Cloti. More on this interview on Nightline Africa this Saturday. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Remember to connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And for now, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great weekend ahead, Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.